Hello and welcome back to Heights Library's podcast, Unpacking 1619, where you can explore the interviews we've collected with scholars from around the country, in which we unpack topics relating to race in America. I'm your host, John Pichet, and I'm thrilled to share these interviews with you here. Zane Gill is the chair of the Anti-Racism Social Justice Transformation Committee and faculty member in Justice Studies at San Jose State University. She talks about how All Lives Matter has advanced whiteness in the news. Using critical race theory's critique of neoliberalism's use of race-neutral racism, Professor Gill discusses how All Lives Matter works to undermine the civil rights meaning of Black Lives Matter by denying its central critique. Blue Lives Matter, an offshoot of All Lives Matter, restores police as the victims of their jobs, protecting the wealthy and corporate interests of domination. Looking into how all stands for white, Professor Gill illustrates how Black Lives Matter movement is drained of meaning and replaced by white supremacist fears and solutions. Here's our discussion from August 10th, 2023.
My name is Zane Gill, and I'm a professor in justice studies at San Jose State University.
Well, thank you for joining us, and we're going to be discussing your article, Reporting from the Whites of Their Eyes, How Whiteness as Neoliberalism Promotes Racism in the News Coverage of All Lives Matter. And I believe this was written in 2020, correct? Communication 30, yeah. So if you could kind of, if you would first begin by telling us how you came to write this article, and if there was anything that you learned like immediately by doing it.
Yeah, actually, the inspiration for this article was actually a conversation I had with my kid. My kid is African-American, and I adopted them from the foster agency when they were 15. And the debates with Trump as a presidential candidate started taking over the news. And my kid, as an African-American, was really alarmed by All Lives Matter and felt viscerally attacked by it. And so I was kind of inspired by those conversations with my kid to tackle and pursue All Lives Matter more critically and strategically than how it had been treated in the news media at the time.
Yeah, and I like how you begin the article by framing whiteness and in the context of All Lives Matter. But before we get into that, would you please just give us an example or define for us what All Lives Matter is as a concept, as a movement, where it kind of came from? And then I think that'll lead us into the more detailed discussion.
Yeah, it's not a movement. It's a strategic rhetoric that's used to advance notions of white supremacy in a really gaslighting type of way, in the sense that it uses the universalism of civil rights rhetoric by insisting that, you know, everybody has rights and everybody has a humanity that should be respected, but subverts it in a way to serve white supremacist structures and hegemony. So it's basically a strategic tool of whiteness to undermine the gains of such on-the-ground movements like Black Lives Matter. And so my efforts in doing this article was to kind of unveil those strategies of rhetoric so that it could be more easily seen by others as a means of white supremacy instead of a means for diversity.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah, that's a great differentiation between Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter, because I think we've heard it probably most as just kind of like, well, if Black Lives Matter, don't all lives matter? Kind of as a comeback to that sort of just critique. And then, but let's talk about what's behind All Lives Matter. And when you say white supremacy and whiteness, define for us what that strategic rhetoric is and how white, All Lives Matter factor into that.
Yeah, so in my work, because I situate my work within critical race theory and particularly whiteness studies, I see the workings of white supremacy, not something that happened pre-1960s, but is something that's active and alive and very powerful right now. So we saw the white backlash in the 1990s, and we're seeing again that white backlash happen in the age of Trumpism and post-Trumpism. And it seems to be the same type of race-neutral pattern of attacking people of color for standing up for their rights, for standing up for their humanity, in very similar ways in the 1990s, but with a different face and with a different force, right, in presidential office. So, and particularly Trump's use of All Lives Matter seems to be easily replaceable with White Lives Matter. And when he's used it in the mainstream media, I think it has kind of like a confusing or obfuscating effect, I think, on people who read this rhetoric, because it seems like it's an uplifting, inclusive thing, when really it is a maintaining of a racial hierarchy in a backhanded, gaslighting type of way, by saying that, you know, people who support Black Lives Matter or Black Lives Matter activists themselves shouldn't really be focused on. It's really everybody that should be focused. All lives matter, not just Black Lives Matter. And how selfish of them to think that Black lives should matter over all lives matter. And so there's psychological elements to it that I think that are very effective for those who lack media literacy in particular. And so it's really important for us to kind of unpack these strategies that seem so universal, and it seems like they should be a big hug to everybody, but really it's a slap in the face to the most marginalized of our society. And we need to call out and dismantle these strategies, because they really do terrible damage to communities of color, marginalized communities, poor communities, for sure.
And these strategies that you're talking about are basically returning always to the white, male, heterosexual, middle class, kind of unmarked in the academic terms. Like, what am I looking for? The word is that's the norm, or that's where everything is expected to start, correct?
Yeah. So I think critical race theory and whiteness studies, which is an offshoot of critical race theory, does this really well in terms of showing how when we try to flatten difference in this all-encompassing way, right? Like, so let's say, you know, Black Lives Matter are really trying to focus on the intersections of, you know, race and class and gender, to show how when those intersections collide at certain marginalities, that the injustice that gets produced is rather savage. And then on the flip side, you have this, what you call this unmarked position of like whiteness, of maleness, of wealth, of privilege, and things of that nature, that tends to be the status quo from which people kind of talk about life, but that doesn't apply to all of us. That only applies to those that are institutionally privileged. And that becomes the eye, right? So that's why I said reporting from the whites of their eyes, is because, you know, I know that it's an American Revolutionary reference, but it's also, you know, I'm bringing it to modern day to say, hey, I think that the reporting that's happened, and I don't pick extremist newspapers to analyze, I pick, you know, newspapers that, you know, that are either moderate or liberal, and showing how even these moderate or liberal mainstream corporate newspapers can really advance white supremacy, even though they think they might be covering in a fair, neutral way these social justice movements or these social justice debates.
Right. And before we get into the how the media kind of creates this fake notion or artificiality of objectivity, I'd really like to move into a definition of neoliberalism, because we're going to talk about that as we move through what you found. And I think we really need to hammer home what the neoliberalist project is, and specifically how it ties in with that notion of white supremacy and that white normalization that we were just talking about.
Yeah. So neoliberalism in academia tends to be a very lofty concept, but it's really important. And my objective in like summarizing the neoliberal literature was to really try to make it as graspable as possible, because I really think some very important economic transformations have happened with neoliberalism that directly affect our lives on an everyday level. But because we talk about neoliberalism in this very kind of abstract, lofty way, I don't think it's trickling down well enough. So for me, in my review of neoliberalism, it was very much a hard translation of these very interesting academic concepts into how it plays out on the ground for everybody else. So neoliberalism is basically, you know, this kind of economic application of the liberal concept that defines our democracy. But the way that it's kind of evolved and transformed over the decades is to actually privilege the privileged and disadvantage the poor and marginalized. But using these subtle rhetorics of, let's say, public versus private, or, you know, people who have freedom of movement and people who don't have freedom of movement, or, you know, protecting some people's property against others who might steal that property, etc. And so what I try to do with my article is to show that, you know, we have these really interesting theoretical folks who talk about neoliberalism affecting, let's say, the welfare system or the prison industrial complex. And those are really important interventions because it shows how, you know, we're doing these projects that don't seem to be really helping the people that are, you know, getting, you know, crunched up in these systems. But what we're doing is we're kind of sending these messages that, like, you know, the rich can get richer, corporations can have free speech, but, you know, poor people, if you steal bread, or if you, you know, try to take care of your daily needs in the informal economy, you're going to go to prison. So it's this real kind of privileging of those who kind of have wealth, who are invested in the rise of corporations, who want that like middle class life without understanding the broader structures of how that wealth and that privilege is gained at the expense of the most marginalized, the most raced, the most economically disadvantaged communities, and how our investment in social programs like the prison industrial complex or defunding welfare or such really isn't about, you know, individuals taking responsibility for themselves. When you look at the broader picture, it's about, okay, it's about criminalizing the poor and the marginalized in order to create wealth at the top, and to also heavily monitor and police those that live at the bottom of society for the benefit of those who are at the top 1% or more.
Yeah, that's a great description of it. And I think the one thing that I would add to it that is going to come up in when we start talking about what you found is I want to really stress that, you know, the government's reduced to a police force and police function, and that carceral state that you mentioned, and how business is all, you know, redefined as kind of as a person in like Citizens United, and suddenly individuals take on a whole new corporate abstract entity in the neoliberal state. So that's happening, while at the same time on the ground, Black Lives Matter is happening as a result of what we know, police brutality and targeting at-risk communities. So how does the media translate this dynamic, and how does it then, with the All Lives Matter kind of retort or, you know, snide comeback, how does that take on some gravity, and how does that even, you know, how is it as serious How is it dealt seriously when it seems so flippant?
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of elaborate on your comments just now, you know, we all have bodies. But neoliberalism has given corporations actual bodies that with actual legal protections. And they've also given corporations an actual voice to use money as speech, like an actual person would. And the coverage of these neoliberal maneuvers does not even match the coverage of, let's say, the on-the-ground street crime that happens on the daily, right? But I would argue that the neoliberal maneuvers that give corporations a body and a voice and rights like a body, like a human body has, is way more dangerous for our democracy than the upsurge in post-pandemic crime that we're experiencing right now. So that's the mind trick, I think, of neoliberalism, is that it can make these incredibly risky transformations to our democratic society, but yet still act in this somewhat sensational manner when it comes to the news media by focusing our attentions on fear of crime, when our democracy is actually seriously at stake with what's happening in the news media industry right now.
And that's such an important point in your article too, because you bring in that the news media seems to be intent on only creating white fear. And if not creating it, then at least fueling it. So, you know, it's not mentioned in the article, but an example is, you know, we don't have immigrants coming into the country. We have a horde of immigrants. You know, and that, so that's one of the ways that that would happen. And
or a wave. Yeah.
Right.
Like we're going to be drowning in immigrants. Yeah.
Right. And in your book, you talk a lot about that. And that's where I'm drawing that from. But the when you have a movement like Black Lives Matter or any sort of civil rights uptick where the disenfranchised come into their own voice, how does the media react to that voice? How does it broadcast it? How does it interpret it? What does it, and how does this dynamic between Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, how does all that get jumbled together when they're not really on equal footing? Or are they? How does that dynamic work?
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to show in my article, you know. So initially it was just going to be an All Lives Matter analysis, but, you know, I figured out that limiting it to that would kind of hide a richness of data with how these things were like kind of co-constituted with other groups. That's why I kind of just stuck with Lives Matter. How is Lives Matter constructed, right? And so that helped me kind of open the door to not only All Lives Matter, but also Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, Police Lives Matter. And so that's where I started to see more clearly the different strategies that were happening in the data in terms of how All Lives Matter constructed, how Black Lives Matter was co-opted by All Lives Matter, and how Police Lives Matter actually does make a factor into how these Lives Matter debates are constructed. And so for me, it was to show this, like, unfortunately, this white supremacist underpinning that happens not with All Lives Matter, but also with Police Lives Matter. And the way that both of them are deployed in mainstream media coverage is highly problematic, supremely undermining a Black Lives Matter movement and values, and is really an attempt to just do an injustice to calls for, civil rights and, social justice for these communities. So that's why, I picked, newspaper venues that people read on the daily and they trust, you know, as being fair, objective, unbiased, balanced, all those, you know, news media terms that is supposed to mean that they're without any kind of, you know, attached value. But let's scratch the surface, because there's some really strong and problematic racism that's happening that we need to discuss and that we need to uncover. Because the more that our news media outlets become more vertically integrated, you know, and we only have the big five corporates, you know, outlets basically that control most of our media, this becomes really disconcerting, the way that they cover things that are as important as social justice issues.
Yeah, and I really liked how you bring in the idea of the race neutrality, the flattening, and how those tactics, those rhetorics, undermine, they don't so much build up White Lives Matter, though that's what they're ultimately doing, but they really are designed to tear down Black Lives Matter by equalizing the injustice, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I really took a lot of inspiration from the work of Chandra Mahanty. She wrote Feminism Without Borders, and really her kind of take on the neoliberal transformations and the ways in which that they're focused on, you know, making the world more cosmopolitan for the privileged, but making it less traversable and movable for those who are poor, that include, you know, impoverished communities, as well as immigrants. And I think that you can see that with maneuvers like the Muslim travel ban with Trump, and, you know, the different other, you know, maneuvers that we see with the border. You know, you can look at people's TikToks, and yes, it's so great that they visit Greece or Italy or whatever, and that's what you're supposed to do in this neoliberal world, right? But at the same time, you're denying people the right of their movements to find work, to have families, to want to feed their families, et cetera, with things like, you know, the militarization of the border or the Muslim travel ban, which is like the new version of the Chinese Exclusion Act, right? So yeah, we're in some troubling times, troubling waters right now.
And the other two pillars of this media rhetoric or media story that it tells are the fear of Black power, and how that's always a white fear. It's always a zero-sum game where we're always, white communities always under attack from some sort of other who's coming to take power from. And then how that plays into the police, and then also how all actually is a substitute for white. So if you could unpack that for us, because I think even in your article, you quote someone like de Blasio, who ultimately, Black Lives Matter, but at the end of the day, white life, all lives matter, right? And he says it without thinking what he's saying as, and then it, so if you could unpack that as well. So the white fear and how all functions as this kind of hinge between the two worlds of white and yeah.
I mean, the easiest way for me to see it in the data was obviously Trump. So when Trump, you know, had the meeting where he was trying to court Black voters, and in his incredibly boasting ways, you know, he was saying how he's going to meet with these Black leaders, and they're going to give him his endorsement. And, you know, he believes in Black Lives Matter, but he really believes in all lives matter more, you know, that kind of thing. And it just struck me that, you know, he doesn't mean all, he means white, right? But he's using all as a cover for white, because he knows that there's a line drawn. And so he's very good at using these kind of really tough, but like it works, the rhetoric works, right? So it was his entryway that I used to introduce the article, to kind of show in a rough sense how that works, how you can use All Lives Matter to undermine Black Lives Matter. But later on, when I used de Blasio, Mayor de Blasio's part of the snippet of his speech that was covered by the news media, that also kind of showed the way in the sense that he was giving a speech to try to kind of placate and kind of settle fears, right? By talking about Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter in this kind of interchangeable way. But in that interchange, something gets undermined and something gets boosted. And so that, and what happens is that Black Lives Matter gets undermined and All Lives Matter gets boosted. It would be interesting to see. I don't think de Blasio would probably use All Lives Matter now, right? I think there's a learning curve when we have all these debates, right? And I think now people are more aware that Blue Lives Matter is, you know, has overlapping value system with, you know, white supremacy groups and things of that nature. And All Lives Matter hurts, you know, Black Lives Matter movement. But at the time, yeah, he used these interchangeable notions that ultimately underlie Black Lives Matter. And so even with, you know, politicians who are seen as liberal and down with the movements and things of that nature can still do some damage, you know, when you embrace race neutral language and politics.
And that, explain that a little bit more, because I think this gets lost a lot, the flattening of issues and how race neutrality is actually not neutral, and it's actually supporting a dominant narrative of white supremacy. Because I think this is something that people, I know I had to learn it, and I think it's something that's confused a lot.
So what I kind of show in the different examples ultimately is that All Lives Matter attempts to flatten all the differences that Black Lives Matter and other social groups are trying to, you know, wave red flags to say, hey, this is serious. There's some serious injury here. There's some serious injustice that we need to take a look at. And so that kind of flagging, that red flagging of saying, hey, this is like blue on black violence that we need to talk about, right? All Lives Matter is a flattening of difference. It wants to take the difference out, right? And it's in the line with these kind of race neutral, racist projections, basically. And here's the thing, like, this came out of the civil rights era. You know, I mean, we can remember, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. saying, you know, I have a dream, and it was for their kid to live in a world, you know, that kind of thing. And you know, a lot of his rhetoric embraced this race neutral, you know, everyone deserves to have this dream, you know. But things have happened since the death of Martin Luther King to the civil rights movement, where that neutralism that he used in his speeches has been now turned around and been kind of used as an instrument of harm instead to these social justice movements, especially in the legal tradition, because the legal tradition doesn't see citizens as groups. The legal tradition can only see citizens as individual entities, right? And so it can't see group harms in that kind of liberalism framework. And I'm not talking about liberalism as in terms of liberal or conservative. I'm talking about the philosophy of liberalism that undergirds our democracy. And so that critical race theory, for critical race theory, that's the heart of the problem, is that our laws cannot see group harm and only individual harm. And so that race neutrality that was an inspiration in the civil rights era is now a harm to the groups that are trying to get justice at that group level. Because again, that neutrality is being evoked, where it's like, no, not black, all is the better way to go. And then you don't look at black anymore because you're looking at the all. And so we're in a really discombobulating time, right? Because rhetorics that we thought were inspirational and kind of guided social justice norms of anti-racism are suddenly being used against those same communities of color to undermine their power position for social justice?
Well, the way I think about it, and this may be wrong, is you have a sentiment like Martin Luther King's speech about, and he's talking about, being judged on your character. But then he goes on to say that that's not what's happening, and to get there, we have to do a lot of other, so it's draining the meaning. It's like if you have a gas tank and it's draining it down, so it's just barely running that car. And to me, that's what flattening means. So it's like you're taking all the real meaning out of it and bringing it back to like this baseline. And in the article, you talk about it as being like an information bias. And I think that really kind of opened my, so am I wrong in thinking about it like that? Is it doing that?
That's absolutely correct. Yeah, it is absolutely correct. Yeah, it's just a way to not see difference. To be like, our value system should be pointing to not seeing difference, to not see blackness, to see all. But it doesn't say, but you're using all like white, you know? So that's the main issue, you know? So you can still have people who embrace liberalism or vote as Democrats, and they're still honestly use All Lives Matter as something that's uplifting, you know, something that we should be, you know, trying to aspire to without necessarily realizing the damage they're doing to Black Lives Matter, who's just saying, hey, we're not being treated equally. Can we just take a second to like look and see the systemic harm that's happening because of skin color and historical context? And so, yeah, that it is. It's taking the gas out of the gas tank of these social justice movements by doing some wordsmithery that takes the love and compassion, right, out of seeing this particular social movement as legitimate and delegitimizing them by using universal language.
Right. And then it ties back into what you were talking about with the law, whereas if the law can't see, if it only sees individuals, then racism is exceptional. And it's not systemic because only individuals can do it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why the bar to proving racism in our law is so high. You know, someone has to use the N-word. Someone has to say blatantly racist things, which like basically makes it so hard to prove things like unconscious bias or, you know, the types of racism that happen without having using bad words or historically awful labels toward another person. And so that's where I think the real racist battle is happening, on that discursive level. And so that's where my research interest is not the blatant racism that's happening, but this like really subtle discursive war that happens in our everyday newspapers and our everyday news media coverage.
So once you have exposed it and once you can see it, what is the prognosis? What do we do with that information? What are your suggestions for remedies?
Yeah, I mean, in the article, it seems to me very clearly that journalism needs a revolution in values. The way that it's operating right now, in terms of some of its dated or even updated, you know, journalistic values, needs an overhaul. Because the way in which the vertical integration of the media system right now is working, I think that's just only going to churn out more and more of this whiteness in the coverage of news. It's going to have to take an investment, and I know affirmative action is not really favored right now among the courts, as we see a regression post-Trump. But that's basically what it's going to take. We need way more people of color in the newsroom as editors up the chain of command in order to see changes, on the dailies with the news coverage. And we also need, and I don't talk about this in the newspaper, I mean, in my article, but I think it's pretty implicit, like we really need to understand neoliberalism and how it's working in our daily lives and the damage that it's doing. We see such favorable coverage of the rich all the time, and the desecration of the poor and marginalized. And that really is one of the most striking examples of how neoliberalism has affected the mainstream news media. And I think it has really terrible effects, again, for our democracy and the way that we treat other people. And so unless a revolution in journalism takes place really soon, not just in terms of its economic structuring, but also in its newsroom, who's reporting, who's managing, who's, you know, in control of the newsrooms, you know, I don't think that much is going to change.
Thanks for listening to Unpacking 1619. For more information on Heights Library 1619 Project Discussion Group, or to check out more interviews with scholars, please visit heightslibrary.org. See you next episode, wherever you listen to podcasts.